You know, then we are more attractive to each other. And I think it has to do with that idea that God is love. And so when we are able to express love in any way in our day-to-day activity, then we are really sort of aligned and energized in a way that we are designed to show up in life. So we're talking on the, you know, June new month, and I introduced this last week, but the theme, the Centers for Spiritual Living theme for the whole month of June is accountability, and I just, you know, that just has such a seriousness to it. So last week we played with it, and I wanted to tie it in today with the way that we are accountable. When you look at the fact that we're divine beings living in these physical bodies, the way that we are really accountable to express love in our life, to have love in our life, to be lovable and to be loved and to just kind of partake in all of that great exchange. Because I was thinking about it when Clyde was talking about the giving consciousness. That is the law of circulation. And I think that we look at it in lots of different ways. But in terms of love, it's such a beautiful illustration of how we have to give it, but we also have to receive it in order to have the fullness of that experience. So, so when I thought that I would talk about being accountable to love, I wanted to follow through with all the stuff I talked about last week, where I said, don't make accountability a bad word. Let's have a new idea. So when I looked at what I spoke about last week, I realized that I had sort of accidentally created my very own definition of accountability. You'll like it much better than the dictionary definition. And I think we should call me, you could say that this would be, would it be Wiki Karen or Karen Wiki or something? But anyhow, this is my definition of accountability, and I think it's quite good. Accountability is the logical, yet not punitive, approach to participating in our own well-being, knowing that we live in a natural realm of cause and effect. Is that good? I know, I really thought it was good. And actually, I really said that last week, but when I looked at those notes, I went, man, that is really good. I'm going to form it into a, you know, we'll get it published somewhere. We'll publish it. That's what we'll do. Then we can know it's out there. So get on that, Chris Lockman. You'll be able to find that in my notes later. It should be out later this week. What, Monday, Tuesday? Maybe they can expect to be able to find it publicly on Facebook or something. So accountability is the logical yet not punitive, right? That's why we don't like those words like responsibility and commitment and accountability, because we punish ourselves in some way by feeling guilty if we don't live up to whatever it is we think we're supposed to live up to. So what if we changed that and saw the logic in it, realize it's that we live in this universe that demonstrates that amazing law of cause and effect all the time, and as we learn about it more, as we understand it and begin to practically apply it in our own life, then we are really choosing to participate in life for our very own well-being. And I think that's really good stuff. So now, logically, as we start reasoning all this stuff, we can begin by noticing that indeed there is some kind of extraordinary example of perfect order in the universe, of that reciprocal law, of that law of circulation, the way there's always that process of give and take in nature in every way. I love how the plants that die out in the fall become the compost that new growth will come out of. And so there's this way that all of life is connected to every other part of life. So as we begin to see that we are a part of all of that, that we really play in that whole idea of oneness, then what we can begin to see is that everything we believe about God is true about us too. So as we know we live in an intelligent universe, Why, we can claim that wisdom, that intelligence, because it is divinely given. It is inherited in our very being. As we begin to understand that essence of infinite intelligence, of that perfection, the way we say a perfect, whole, and complete. So we already have everything we need to align ourselves to these ideas. And then we come to that real big one, that proverbial way we understand oneness in that proverbial way that we are like a drop from the big ocean. Okay, so we are. If you look at our physical makeup, we are everything that the ocean is. In other words, the sea of life, the universe, God. We have all those elements. We are not all that God is, but we are made of all that stuff. And so our potential for perfection and intelligence and wisdom and joy and love is already given to us. So this is good news. This is very good news for us. Not only are we an essential piece of the whole, but the universe is incomplete without us. That's right. That's right. So we have this faculty to reason. We begin to understand that of all our abilities, we are absolutely every bit as extraordinary as this entire universe, as this gorgeous planet that we live in, and on, I guess, and as all of this magnificent life that we are a part of. So last week I said, it's just really fun to say it, so I'm going to say it. We have capability, possibility, and responsibility, and we talked about having that ability to respond, responsibility, that ability to respond. Therefore, and hopefully, that will lead us to, I have to say this just right. So capability, possibility, responsibility, if we reason on that, will lead us to a sensibility, which then makes accountability the natural invitation, leading us ultimately to have more joy and have more freedom and just have a greater experience in our living. There are a lot of words that end in ability. As a matter of fact, Google said there's more than 394. I thought at first I was going to try and squeeze them all in, but then I realized you would probably get rather tired of it. So thank you for humoring me. I'm not quite done. I'll just say I have one more round of it because it's so doggone fun. So the bottom line is this. Our capability, all of our capability is God-given. And so if we're going to look at love today, the way that everybody loves a lover and the way that all of us are drawn to love in that beautiful divine way, then what we can say is that capability to express and be love is a God-given gift, and therefore we are talking today about love ability. It's a real word. I didn't make that one up. It is a real word. So everybody loves a lover. Not only are you lovable and able to give and receive love, but you have a proficiency for it. Imagine that. Now, how often do we think about that? You know, we don't often look at it quite that way. What we do is we notice when we don't feel like we're getting enough of it, when we're feeling alone or separated from it, or when we just don't know how to give it because somebody has done something that absolutely annoys us, right? And so then that stops that natural inborn capacity to be a part of the flow of love on this planet and in our life. The dictionary takes that word capacity and says this: a capacity is an ability to perform or achieve certain actions or outcomes. And then it goes on to say, it is a capacity is the means or the skill to do something. I love that it has the word or in the middle of it. It is the means or the skill, which means if we're feeling like we're not very skilled at anything, that we are still provided with the means to have that which we desire to have in our life, and that's what this philosophy is all about. That is the truth that we speak about every Sunday and in every class we teach. So in terms of lovability, it really is a matter of whether or not we choose to use our gifts. Now, I will confess that I don't wake up every day feeling just all that lovable. You know, there are, you of course probably do because you're well-schooled being here every Sunday like you are. But I will tell you that there are days or times or situations or predicaments where I just don't feel very loving or I don't feel lovable. And if you don't feel lovable, guess what's going to happen in your life? You're not going to get much because you're not open to receive it. So what we teach and the way that I feel sort of saved by our teaching here is that it teaches us to pay attention, to observe when you're not being lovable. And as Emma Curtis would say, you name it, so that you can call in that which you do want. And you can start to take a look at what's blocking you from that full experience of having that love. So the only thing that can ever be missing is my own awareness of the presence of love right where I am, right where we are at any given moment. The presence of love is right there because God is love, and there is no place that God is not, so we cannot be deprived or limited of that experience in any way because we are born with a capacity for it. We are born with the capacity to be proficient in it. So the instant I observe I have not been feeling lovable or loved or whatever it is, the instant I recognize that, I am now removing those obstacles or blocks that have just blinded me for a little while, and voila, in that moment, love is there. Because it was never gone. That's what this is all about. So you might say, okay, this is the last time I'm going to get really corny, but oh, this is going to be so fun if you're me. You might say accountability starts with observability. And the availability of that capability of observability now has credibility to it. Ta-ta! I wrote the whole talk just so I could say that. That was really fun. I feel so satisfied. Last week, I was peeking at Facebook, which sometimes makes me feel loving and sometimes doesn't. I'll just confess that. But I was peeking at Facebook, and I saw this fabulous quote. It kind of reminded me of Rumi a little bit. It was from a guy named Fred Allen. Okay, now watch what happens in the room. How many of you know of Fred Allen? Okay, more than I expected, because most of the snowbirds are gone now. So that decreases how many hands go up on something like this. Fred Allen had a radio show. He was a comedian, an American comedian, had a radio show in the 1930s and the 1940s, and apparently he liked to play with Jack Benny. They had a constant ongoing thing back and forth, and people like Groucho Marx and Henry Morgan and even Johnny Carson are said to have been influenced in their comedic style by this comedian, Fred Allen. But here's the quote I read on Facebook. It's so lovely. I saw him walking down Lover's Lane holding his own hand. Isn't that lovely? I love that. And so when I heard that line, when I read that line, I went, oh, that'll go so good in the message this week. I'm going to use that. And then I remembered as I was playing with that it reminded me very much of, I thought it was a Rumi poem, and it turned out it was Hafiz, and it took me a while to find my Hafiz book because my husband had it in his corner of the house, but I found it. It's back in my library now. Thank you, darling. He likes Hafiz too. But this is one of my most favorite Hafiz poems. I would read you my most favorite, but it's a little too naughty for Sunday morning. It's called When I Wanted to Kiss God. When no one is looking, I swallow deserts and clouds, and I chew on mountains knowing that they are sweet bones. When no one is looking and I want to kiss God, I just lift my own hand to my mouth and kiss. Isn't that gorgeous? So Hafiz, like Rumi, is a Sufi poet. And what we know about the Sufis is that they have this passionate love for the divine, that they're very demonstrative in the way that they write about it and speak about it. And some of it does seem a little bit too naughty for church. But it is a love of God that they're expressing. And so I think that there's a distinct message here, in part about our willingness to love ourselves and to recognize that as we love ourselves, we are loving God. But more than that, I was thinking about it this way. If you want to demonstrate how much you love God, then we must demonstrate the love of God. We demonstrate, we move through our life with that love of God. So it's not limited, it's the allness of that love that God is. And that kind of understanding helps me hear the Fred Allen quote again in a sweet way. I saw him walking down Lover's Lane, holding his own hand, right? So I think it helps us to understand when we're looking at this idea of everybody loves a lover, that there is something attractive, something that draws us to people that are sort of effusive in the way they love, in the way they show up in that essence of love that God is, that, and we're drawn to that. We like the confidence that we see in that. Now, that reminded me of a story I haven't told in quite some time. I can't even remember where I first read it. But Ernest Holmes, who is the founder of this teaching, The Science of Mind, Ernest Holmes was traveling from the Los Angeles area to the East Coast in order to deliver a lecture. So he's going to entertain himself during the time that he's traveling by praying. And he decides he's going to do this little experiment. He's going to pray just that he can love the people that he's about to go deliver this lecture to, and that he wants to love them in a way like he has never loved before. And so he created a spiritual mind treatment, a prayer, with all these affirmations about his ability to just love the people. And he does this all the way across the country. He gets to where he needs to be. He delivers the lecture. And there's such a great response that more than the average number of people come forward after the lecture is done, and they all come up to him, and they're very warm and complimentary and very tender with him. And somebody was observing all of this happening. And so this person now comes to Dr. Holmes when the crowd is sort of thinning out. And the person says to Ernest, "Dr. Holmes, it must be wonderful to be loved so much by so many people." What was that? He didn't pray to be loved. He prayed to be more loving. He prayed to be able to extend his love in a greater way than he had done before. So I was thinking of that beautiful Emma Curtis Hopkins quotation that says, "Lord, show me the way to make the world glad and sane." And I would say that way has to be in that art of love, of that divine love that we talk about so frequently. Lao Tzu, who lived about 2,000 years before Jesus, said, "See the world as yourself. Have faith in the way that things are. Love the world as yourself. Then you can care for all things." Do you hear a little ring of familiarity in that? It is like that. It's like, do unto others as you would have others do unto you. Treat your neighbor as you would like to be treated. It's that great essence of the golden rule. So if we look at those words, love the world as yourself, see the world as yourself, and then he goes so far as to say, have faith in the way that things are. Well, now how do we do that? See, I think it's pretty easy to have faith when everything's going your way. When everything looks pretty rosy in the world and you prayed for it to look that way and you're feeling pretty satisfied with yourself, I think that's great, but I'm not so sure that's the same kind of faith it takes to read the news, to follow CNN or watch the news on TV or to just Google what's going on in the world. Now that takes some faith. Can we do that while we stand grounded in the center of truth, because that's where the love is. And that's what we teach here. So every time we have that kind of faith, and man, I think some days, and the world doesn't look pretty every day. And it's not just now, you know, I mean, you know, there's always stuff. But there's big change going on, and I'm excited about it. And I want everybody to be a little more excited about it, because as things break loose, we can restructure, or as Swedenborg says, that when things fall apart, then God can jump in and rearrange things in a divine order. Then we have more hope, and that's what it takes real faith to be able to do. Can we calm ourselves down when we need to calm down a little bit? Can we shush our scattered and scary thoughts as they're moving through our minds? Can we find our own center again? Yes, we can. Absolutely. Absolutely. It is everything we are about here. So here's the deal. When the life that I am observing in my outer world does not fit with the peace that I desire to have on my inner world, then something's got to change. And it's got to change inside of me. Because that something that has to change, that something is that capability we've been talking about. It's that something that is that natural, inborn capacity for life. And I love, again, I'm going to take you right back to where that definition says a means or a skill. So if I'm not feeling very skilled at being lovable at any given moment, I can remember that I have the means to take me back to the beginning again. We are proficient in our ability to love. We just get sidetracked with all the things that change the energetic of love into something that is not as pretty, that is not as peaceful. I think that as I pondered all of this, I was thinking about sort of a fail-safe method I learned about 25 years ago when I first started studying A Course in Miracles, which predated my Science of Mind days. And there's this great approach to dealing with difficult people in The Course in Miracles that is truly a fail-safe. If somebody is being absolutely horrible through your perspective, doesn't mean it's real, but if you're perceiving it, then one of the things that might really help us is to see that if they're not acting loving, then they are demonstrating an act that is a call for love. So much the way my adorable little granddaughter Annabelle, if she misses her nap, is not much fun to be around later in the day. Sometimes the only thing I can do when she's fussy and she's visiting and I can't bear her whining, and did I say that out loud? I have a lot of grandkids and I raised a lot of kids, but when she is just being difficult, I sit down, I change my expectation of how she needs to act, behave, or be, and I sit down in the most loving way that I can and I hold her. And see, that's what we all desire. When I see somebody, if I'm in the store and somebody's being rude to somebody else and it's a total stranger, or I see it on the road, or I'm in the middle of it in my own life in some way, then what if we could stop having all of our judgments and see that whatever it is that we're not liking right there is simply a call for love? And by the way, if I just tried to love her without sort of sneaking it in, the only way to love her when she's fussy is for me to get that love moving in me. Because if I'm frustrated and I try and hold her, she's going to pick up on that. So don't be trying to smooth out other people's problems in the grocery store. If it has nothing to do with you, maybe it's best to leave it be and love them from a distance. Because we can do that, and I think that might be the whole point. We have hundreds of opportunities, maybe even every day, to love people, to create a space of peace and love, and to see beauty in the shenanigans of other people's lives. And when we can stand in that space, then we are not dodging love, we're not denying it, we're not making something that is not love bigger than it needs to be. We are standing in a place where we are allowing that proficiency for God's love to exude through us, to express as us in our encounters. So no matter what's going on, my advice is just love people anyway. Now, there's a beautiful scripture in the Bible that I have loved, not when I was a fundamentalist, I didn't get it yet, but as a minister, I rediscovered this passage, and it's found in the book of Luke, and it's that scripture that says, to the one who loves much, much is forgiven. To the one who loves much, much is forgiven. So that scripture kept going through my mind this week as I was developing the message. And I did some research around it. And you know, it comes from the story in Luke where it's referred to as the woman with the alabaster jar. And she was known to be a sinful woman. In fact, one of my Bibles actually has that as the subheading before the story starts. The sinful woman that anoints Jesus' feet. That was actually one of the subheadings. But it's the story of the woman with the alabaster jar. And the story goes like this. The Pharisees were always sort of watching Jesus, not really sure what was going on, not really sure whether they were pleased with his presence or not. And so one of the Pharisees, a man named Simon, invited Jesus to come to his house and have dinner with him. Now, at this point in the biblical account, it says that Jesus said yes, and he went to Simon's house, and he came inside, and he sat down. He went to the table where they were going to have their meal, and he reclined. So I thought, that's odd. I've never really examined this in great detail. So I pulled out my very best study Bible, and it said this, that they, understanding why they would recline while they were eating, well, it was the custom that dinner guests would lie on couches or benches with their heads near the table, propping themselves up with an elbow and stretching their feet out behind them. Isn't that interesting? Probably some reasons for that. You know, I don't know. I won't. Let me not move too far away from what I was going to say, because it always gets dangerous when I do that. That's why I practice a lot in the mirror, so I don't do that. Okay, so Jesus is now reclined at the table, and the woman, who was known as the woman who was very sinful, which means she had made some errors in her life. She probably had shown poor judgment in some of the decisions she had made or avoided, because sometimes our big problems come when we just don't make those decisions, right? So she's in the house. She comes in the house now, but she is not an invited guest. You know, and why is she there? It doesn't really say, but I want to say that she was, because it fits with the talk, she was probably drawn by that love. She was attracted by the love that this man Jesus was emanating. And so she comes to the house, and she enters with her alabaster jar, and it's filled with very expensive perfumed oil. Now, an alabaster jar would have been a jar that was hand-carved from some of the local stone. It would be much like a beautiful piece of marble, and it would be very valuable. So she has her alabaster jar, and it's filled with this very expensive oil, and she goes right up to Jesus. Now, he's reclined at the table, and his legs are behind him. So she goes, and she kneels on the floor, and she begins to weep. She's so honored to be in the presence of the teacher. And as she weeps, her tears fall on his feet. And then remember this passage? She takes her hair and she wipes his feet with her hair. And then she's weeping and crying, and she begins to kiss his feet, and she kisses and kisses his feet. Now, the Pharisees were not happy about it, as often happens. The Pharisee Simon, whose house it was, began observing this and having an opinion about it, and he becomes rather accusatory toward Jesus, allowing this sinful woman to clean his feet and to kiss his feet. So Simon says, as if Jesus was not in the room, right? So how rude would that be? He says to all the other guests, he says, if this man were a prophet, he would not let a sinner touch him. See, the Pharisees were always watching Jesus because the Pharisees were not permitted to touch sinful people. So now they're projecting that onto Jesus. And so Jesus, who is like always cool, always knows the right thing to say, right? So Jesus, you know, gets a little riled up. I can just see that sassy, assertive, pumps himself up a little bit, you know. And Jesus says, Simon, you've made some mistakes here. You know, I'm a guest in your home, and the custom is that when I come into your house, you are supposed to greet me with kisses. That is our custom. And you are supposed to wash my feet because as a traveler, we're in our sandals and our feet have been dusty. And you should have washed our feet, and then you anoint my head with oil. You did none of those things, but this woman has lavished me with her tears and her expensive perfume and her kisses. Simon, you kind of missed the whole point here. So he scolds Simon. And then he says, typical Jesus style, Simon, I'm going to tell you a story. Right? So Jesus is always good for a parable or two. And he starts by saying something like, each Bible translation is a little bit different, but it was something like, okay, listen up here. This one's for you. You need to hear this story. I'm telling this story for you specifically, Simon. And so he tells the story. You may remember this, some of you. He tells a story about two men are indebted to the local banker. And one man owes the banker 500,000 pieces of silver, and the other man owes him 50 pieces of silver. And both men are unable to pay their debts. So the banker forgives the debt. The banker cancels out the debt to both men. Now Jesus says to Simon, Simon, which man would be more grateful? Isn't that fun to ponder? Which man would be more grateful? And then Simon says, well, the one who had been forgiven the biggest debt. And Jesus says, yes, that's it. Therefore, I tell you, she is forgiven because she has loved much. And that's where that quote comes from. But here's what I want to say to you this morning. I want you to try to not miss the value of the story. Because what I'm hearing and the way I'm going to interpret for you, the homework, the assignment I'm giving you is to take home this lesson and use it and apply it in your own life in a very personal way. The value of this story is that no matter what your past holds, your future rests in your ability to love. When we love much, much is forgiven. Do not miss this part of the story. She did not go into that house and beg for forgiveness from this man, Jesus, who had that power to redeem her. She did not enter the house in that way. She went in great love. She fell to her knees. She wept at his feet. She cleaned his feet and kissed his feet and oiled his feet with this expensive oil, perfumed oil. She used her tears and her actions, and she demonstrated this great generosity of heart. She demonstrated humility through acts of love. Can you see the difference? I think sometimes that what we think is humility or being a humble presence is not what we have really intended, that it might be much simpler in the way we show up, in our willingness to see that we have a proficiency for love. Let us love that much. A very wise man once said to me, tell them to love the people. Tell them to love effusively. So we love, my friends, not for a reward, not for forgiveness, but because we are capable. And it would be such a waste for us to not use what has been freely given to us. And so I wanted to close this morning with a short quote from Rabbi Julius Gordon, who said, love is not blind. It sees more, not less. But because it sees more, it is willing to see less. Take a breath. Nice deep inhale, slow, relaxed exhale. We are going to take these ideas, this feeling, this essence of love that is moving inside of us and active right now. We're going to anchor all of this in the words of prayer.